Welcome to Investor Resources with your hosts, Don Creech and Perry Sykes, who both realize that the market doesn't know what keeps you up at night. It doesn't know when you want to retire, and it doesn't know how old you are. The simple truth is, the market doesn't care. But if you care, then you've tuned in at the perfect time. You're listening to Investor Resources, bringing clarity to the confusing world of finance. Here are your hosts of Investor Resources, Don Creech and Perry Sykes.
Well, good afternoon. This is Don Creech.
And this is Perry Sykes. Welcome to the show, everyone.
So this is the Investor Resources live radio program. That means if you pinch us, it hurts. We know we're awake. But if you have questions about your portfolio, I'm Investor Resources, a registered investment advisor. So we manage money on a discretionary basis for the clients who hire us. If you don't hire us, all you do is kind of get smarter as you listen to this or go to our webinars. Speaking of which, we have one planned every first Saturday of the month, and the next Saturday is May 7th at 9 a.m. But if you want to talk to us today, we have an open phone line. It's 800-465-8770. That's 800-465-8770. And Ben is sitting in the control booth waiting to control our input here.
Indeed.
So anyway, you want to talk to us about your portfolio, the stock market, the Federal Reserve, and what kind of insidious games they are up to.
As if anyone knows, yeah.
Well, we're not really into the conspiracy theory stuff, but if you want to talk about conspiracy theories, the Fed may be a good breeding ground for the ideas. Mm. As this week was a light economic week, has come to an end. The Fed and the Open Market Committee were, and their minutes, were basically driving the headlines, and it was mostly either unexpected or continually depressing. We had a rally on Thursday that looked like the market was going to sustain itself moving upward until Friday opened, and then it went away with a noon effort to kind of reclaim higher territory. And it was kind of like a bunch of brand new skiers on the bunny slopes, and they were back on their bottoms and they sliding downhill.
I thought this was easy. Yeah, what happened? Yeah.
That's what I was told. Look at the grace coming down the hill and the way they kick the snow up and it flies around as they go around their slalom corners. Yeah, well, I never really got real good at doing that, but I did find some contact with the ground a few times.
There you go.
I was, in fact, one of the memorable ones. I know I was in Colorado. I was coming downhill, and when you're skiing, it's kind of like driving. You're never supposed to turn around and look backwards.
Right.
And I did that. I was on my way back down the hill to the lift. I mean, I was almost done with the run, and I didn't look forward. I turned and looked backwards to see where my buddy was, and I hit something, and I did head over heels right underneath the ski lift.
There you go.
I got a nice round of applause for that.
If it had only been on video, yeah, you could have saved that one. That's when you show your friends and family, yes.
Yeah, well, fortunately, I didn't break anything, but there is a question about whether or not the housing market is broken.
Ah.
I mean, the prices are continuing to rise, and it's basically a factor of supply and demand. We have limited supply, and we have the millennials who are wanting to get out of the city. I mean, one, they're starting to have kids, and this is no longer the 50s where you can tell your kids to go out and play in the street, you know,
no.
Catch some ball.
No, that doesn't work anymore. They are looking for that spot, and that's like you said, Don, it's straight up supply and demand. Demand is immensely strong and the supply is short. And unfortunately right now, the most broken part is the supply chain, and the home builders can't get enough stuff or enough people to get those homes built. Or we wouldn't be in as bad a situation as we are now, where there would still be excess demand, but we would at least have a number of new homes coming on the market, and nationwide, it's tough to get those homes finished.
Well, we are just at the start of the new quarter's earnings season. So a lot of the financial news this, well, for the next 6 weeks is going to be, and so-and-so beat earnings. So-and-so was short earnings. They missed by one penny and the stock collapsed 10%, or some story related to that,
That.
So one of the early, I don't actually know that he reported earnings, but he was on a call prepping for the earnings release if he didn't make the announcement. That's Stuart Miller, who's CEO of the home builder Lennar. Mm-hmm. They're a national home builder. They build big projects. And he said in that call that they are taking 6 to 8 weeks longer to build a house. Well, if you are in, and they borrow money to get this stuff done. They don't just say, well, I've got some excess cash in my pocket. I think I'll build 300 homes. That doesn't happen.
Nope.
So they've got a credit line. It's kind of like if you had a construction loan yourself or a home equity line of credit that you were using to go buy a second home. Now you got this interest rate running. And if it takes an extra 2 months to build out a project, that's a lot of extra interest for these guys. Guess what? That raises the cost of the house. Oh, you knew that.
Gets passed on, you bet.
So not only do they have a broken supply chain, they can't get parts. We've talked about that for quite a while now. But as you just said, Perry, they're short labor.
Yep.
Getting people who they need in the construction trades to show up is hard. In fact, I just had breakfast this morning with one of my friends from church, and he's in the construction business, and he and his partner build spec houses. And he said, you wouldn't believe the difficulty we have just trying to finish something and even just getting inspections done. He said, we've called for an inspection 3 times, and they schedule it, and then they cancel, and we have to reschedule. Well, all of that means it's costing them money. They can't move to the next stage of completion, and they're having to pay interest to wait for the inspector to show up. He's getting his paycheck. He's not worried about your bank loan.
Nope, he doesn't have to sell that house. Yeah, the builder. Yeah. The builder's got to move that thing. Yeah.
So we have a broken supply chain and a broken labor force. I mean, we just don't have enough people working because apparently the federal government is still continuing to dole out money for people who want to stay home and play on Zoom. But this last four weeks, actually, the data ended March 13th. So it's the most recent 4 week data. The median home price sale rose 7%. In 4 weeks.
that doesn't seem possible.
We don't have any inflation. This is transitory. There's nothing going on here.
Think of that. That's on top of all the price increases of the last 2 years. And then in a month, it went up another 7%. That is a sign of in increasing demand and decreasing supply. And that also says that the inflation caused by that isn't ending anytime soon. That it's still just roaring out of control right now. So it's seeing that brought under control anytime soon, it doesn't look likely.
And one of the anomalies here is the stocks in the home building business.
Yes.
They aren't doing so well.
Yeah.
You would think, and I had this come up on a webinar last week.
Right. Why aren't the home builders doing better? Yeah.
Yeah, well, because they've got a real profit squeeze when they can't get their jobs done. Now the question is going to be, can they sell them? There are people who want to buy them. That's clear. But when you have a starter home, which is what my friend told me this morning, a starter home in Kitsap County is $400,000 plus to move out of rent. Yeah, well, you need some down payment. You need some cash here to make this thing work. That is slowing that's going to reduce the number of buyers. And then on top of that, and I mentioned the Fed on the opening comments, is that they're raising interest rates. So interest rates on the mortgage business are rising. And they, midweek, they just kind of peaked over and dropped back below that magic 5% number.
Yeah.
They did close the week at 4.72%. But they're going higher. And so if you end up with a mortgage that is above 4, and just, well, you just go back a month or so, a 30-year mortgage on the average house was $2,120. It's now $530 more than it was before the pandemic. We have lots of houses that are under contract if the builders can get them sold. And as mortgage interest rates go up, the payment size goes up.
Yep.
It gets more difficult for people on a fixed income to qualify for the loan.
Yeah, you qualify for less. Yeah, you can't buy the homes you were looking at. You're now priced out of that that category.
So I mean, that's a real pressure. And housing is essential for a healthy economy in the United States of America.
It's a big driver. Once a house is sold, boy, there's so much else that goes with that, to fill it up, finish it off, do the yard. The amount of money that people spend after a purchase is huge. And if we can't get the houses out there, then that money does not enter the economy. And if you spend every last penny shoehorning yourself into the house, you don't have anything left. And so it does materially hurt the rest of the economy when the price of housing keeps ramping up over and over again.
Yeah, you know, that's happened when you drive down the street and the for sale sign's gone, and you look at the windows and you see that they're using bed sheets for curtains.
Right. It's like, oops, that's
they got shoehorned into that house.
Yep. And yep. Now they can't even cover the windows. And that it happens all the time. You know, my daughter was thinking about buying a house. She's pretty much dismissed it for right now, but she still gets alerts. She got one the other day, North Everett, a home for sale for $299,000. And it was like, you got to be kidding me. How can that be true? Until she looked at it. It was a two-story home. The first floor was literally held up by steel braces installed downstairs to keep it from falling down. So it's like, this thing's on the edge of not standing up, and it was still $300,000. I was just flabbergasted. I was like, that's amazing. But that's what's out there right now. It's really tough.
We should
go ahead and get out of here. Yeah, we should go ahead and get out of break. I'd like to remind everyone that we have our next market update webinar scheduled for Saturday, May 7th. That's at 9 a.m. on Saturday, May 7th. You can register for that by going to iriradio.com. That's iriradio.com. Just head over to the webinar page, and there's a registration link there. Give that a click, and you'll get an email back. And on May 7th, you just click that. You'll be live online with us. You'll be able to look at our charts, see what we're thinking, see what we're thinking the market's doing these days. And we always have plenty of time to get to your questions. If you have questions about the market or the economy or even specific holdings in your portfolio and you'd like a second opinion, it's a great time to get that done. So, again, register for that at iriradio.com. If you'd like to talk to us this afternoon, we would love to talk to you about anything to do with the investing in the markets. Give us a call at 800-465-8770. That's 800-465-8770. Stay with us. We will be right back.
You got to know when to hold up, know when to fold up, know when to walk away, and know when to run. You never count your money when you're sitting.
Yeah, well, that's a really important lesson for stock investors, too. And over the last couple of years, particularly, and we've covered this off and on, with the flow of investors into the gaming kind of app called Robinhood.
Mm.
And it sucked in a lot of investors, both in the IPO, the initial public offering, and into trading meme stocks, great ideas. Let's see if we can kick the pants off or the stool out from underneath the big boys
there
who are shorting this thing.
Yep.
And they did. I mean, there was some stuff, and it made investing fun. I never installed the app. I don't know what it looked like, but I was the pictures that I saw, the still shots, it was basically made to look like you're playing a game. You know, it's money, but what's money? You know, this is just fun. I mean, we'll get rich real quickly. And it turns out that some of the riskiest bets in the stock market have, in fact, been the most popular from a volume standpoint anyway. Not everybody knew what they were doing. That's certainly evidence when we look at the data.
There's plenty of stories about that. Plenty of stories, especially, and not just to pick on Robinhood, but plenty of stories from Robinhood investors who, after the fact, found out, oh, there was way more at risk here than I thought. And once we got down to the bottom line, it was like, wow, I've really materially hurt myself here. And as far as I knew, I was really just not at risk. And that's when the light went on and they realized, oh, no, that really is painful.
So we, as investment advisors, portfolio managers, use exchange-traded funds to build our portfolios. The one thing we do not do is use leverage. But it turns out, and whether it's because it's the offshoot of the fun of Robinhood, or people just stumbled into it, some of the most highly traded exchange-traded funds use leverage.
Right.
And the internal operations of them are, one, they have high risk because they aren't actually owning the stocks. They're using derivatives to make leverage plays here. The T triple Q and the S triple Q, which is three times investing long, which means you think the Qs, the NASDAQ 100, are going to go up, and the S triple Q, which is three times leverage on the downside or short, assuming that you think the market's going to tank. Well, most investors don't invest on the downside. I mean, that's the bottom line.
We just don't do it at all, right?
And in fact, there's a lot of professionals who don't really short the market. I mean, basically, in fact, you very rarely hear that on the television or the radio. You know, this thing's really going to tank. We think you should be short this market. I mean, when was the last time you heard that on the airwaves? I mean,
that'd be never. Think. Yeah, you don't hear that. You don't hear that play. And the opportunities are out there, but that is a very very aggressive stance to be taking.
So I just pulled up, because we're here on this subject, I just pulled up the T triple Q, which is betting on the long.
Yes.
And it had a pretty good run, particularly coming out of the dump that we had with COVID. I didn't go take a look at that, but I just know the numbers off the bottom were really, really strong.
Yeah.
From March of 2020 to the high December, it looks like it was November of last year. It's up 790%.
There you go.
Now, there's something in the market called greed. And numbers like that suck a lot of people in, thinking, oh, my goodness, if only I had bought that last year. And
or if I had more money to invest, I would invest more. And that's a way to invest more money than you have. And you should say that to yourself out loud. I'm investing more money than I have. And before you make that leverage buy or sell, because that's how you can get yourself into trouble so quickly if you're wrong. And that happens a lot in investing.
Well, and especially with this one, because the typical investor is a buy and hold investor.
Correct.
That most investors have drunk the Kool-Aid that you shouldn't time the market. That it's always a good time to be in the market. And so they buy something that's done really well, and they assume that it's done well in the past, it's going to do well in the future, because after all, the market always goes up.
Right.
Yeah, and until it doesn't.
And it's always time frame. You know, it's always time frame. And the leverage funds are expensive to own. And if you've made a bet on the upside or the downside and it moves against you, you can lose so much money so quickly that you really don't have time to wait for it to work itself out. And that becomes the problem.
So after the last 4 months, after having gone up almost 800% over the previous several years, if you had been clairvoyant and bought it on March 9th of 2020 and you weren't, you had that 800% gain. And the fact that over the last 4 months, you're only down 41%, you could say, I'm still ahead a lot. And you would be.
Yep.
The problem is most people didn't buy it until late last year, pretty close to the top. So maybe they're not down 41, they're only down 30 in 4 months. So what's the big deal? You bought leverage and you got levered down. Well, and it's not just with the leveraged ETFs. But in many cases, it's listening to Wall Street. Oh, yes. And I just mentioned a moment ago Robinhood, which has collapsed 87% from its peak. And from the initial public offering, it's down a mere 70%. And after having done all that, Goldman Sachs this last week says, oh, by the way, and now Goldman Sachs and Morgan Stanley were the underwriters for the initial public offering.
They brought them public, right?
That's right. Last week, Goldman Sachs says, yeah, we think that's a sell. They're not going to make any money. It's going to be a long time.
Which almost never happens. You know, there's almost never a sell recommendation out there from the buy side folks. It's always maybe hold, but nah, you don't have to sell it. But in the case of Robinhood, it's like, nah, we think you'd probably sell this, even though we helped bring it public. But it wasn't until after, like you said, that over a 70% drop that they decided to pass on the word that we're not sure this is a good place for your money to be. It's like, hey, thanks for the tip, guys, right?
That's right. So you want to talk to us today, we've got a magic number. It's 800-465-8770, 800-465-8770. But you made a point about recommendations off of Wall Street. If you own a stock that you bought because it was on a buy, and later on, they say, well, we think this is a hold.
Yes.
Change the letters to S-E-L-L because the point you made is they very rarely say, you know, we think this is a sell. I mean, because they don't get paid for telling the companies that pay them to do research and sponsor their shares don't pay them to say to the public, we don't think this company's worth investing in. You know, that does not sell well on Wall Street. So when bad news is coming, they change from buy to hold. And that's where they quit.
That hold should be a big flare. Yeah, that's a big red flare going up saying that's not good news right there.
Yeah, that is not good news. That's certainly the case. And I was thinking, in fact, I'm looking at some of our notes from last week here on the board. We had Bob call in. We spent two segments with Bob last week. He had some really good questions. But I was thinking about the question that I just reread. His initial question was, what should I ask my current broker if I want to leave? And so, well, first of all, if we acknowledge he's a broker, he doesn't have a duty to look out for you. Right. He has a duty to sell you something, to hold your hand and keep you in the fold. So if you're concerned about that, the question should be, Mr. Broker, we've done business for a long time, but I am a little concerned about the losses in the account. So tell me, as you make recommendations or changes in my account, are you acting in a fiduciary capacity in every conversation we have? Or in every trade that you make in the account, are you always and only acting as a fiduciary?
Towards me.
Towards me.
Right.
Towards me. That's right. Because they're going to be a fiduciary towards the broker.
Correct.
That is their duty.
That's their job. That's right.
Working as a fiduciary for you requires a different kind of contract. They may have hired an institutional manager for you. That institutional manager and you have a contract, and there's a fiduciary duty there. But the guy sitting on the other side of the desk that you're talking to, that's not his fiduciary duty.
And everybody assumes that it is. Everybody assumes that when they're sitting down with you, the idea is to take care of the client. And that is unfortunately very often not the case. There are so many times where they've been told, hey, we've got X amount of shares of whatever, the XYZ company. We got to move that stuff as fast as we can. Sell it to somebody. We don't care who. We don't care how much. Just sell it. Get move this stuff. And that's often how things come across their desk to you. And while it may look like you're getting this hot tip from your broker, they're just moving stuff out of the way that they have to sell for their company. It's got nothing to do with whether it's good for you or not. And that's too bad.
I didn't really believe that until I worked for E.F. Hutton.
Yes.
And the first of every month, manager came in and said, okay, guys, here's your office quota for this product. You move that, and we don't really care much what else you sell, but this month, here's how much of this one is going out the door in your office. Make it happen. And it just wasn't my cup of tea.
So. No, that's a tough pill to swallow, because you know you're pushing that stuff, sometimes at least, onto people that shouldn't have it. And at least there are better things for them, and you don't get that opportunity a lot of times in a broker-dealer when you're working with that broker, because they have orders to sell that stuff, and that's what they have to do if they're going to keep their job, and they've got bills to pay, and they're going to do it, and that's their job there. That's a broker-dealer's job, you know, to sell those stocks. And it's just important for you as the end client to understand they're not necessarily working in your best interest, and then you can make informed decisions on whether or not you want to follow their advice or not.
Yeah, so the industry's become more sophisticated in how they present that stuff the last several decades. But if you're concerned about that and you want to have a conversation in some detail about that, you can give us a call during the week, and we'd be glad to talk with you. During the week, the number is 800-317-9119, and we'd be glad to discuss your concerns with your current advisor. I mean, that's one of the things they've done. They're no longer brokers. They've changed the name to financial advisors, because it's it's more sophisticated and less affrontive than being a broker.
Broker does not have the cachet it once did.
Right.
So they're running from that a little bit. We are at the bottom of the hour here. Let's go ahead and take our break. I'd like to remind everyone that we do have a weekly email newsletter, The Week in Review, and if you would like to start receiving that, you just need to send us an email. Send that to help@iriradio.com. That is help@iriradio.com. Just put Week in Review in the subject line, and we need your first and last name in the body of the email. We will get you set up, and you will begin receiving that on Monday. It's a very good look at the week's financial news and what's important and the things you can probably safely ignore. Also, if you'd like to talk to us this afternoon, give us a call, 800-465-8770. It's 800-465-8770. You are listening to Investor Resources here on AM 770 KTTH. Stay with us. We will be right back.
So I'm telling you right now, only the strong survive. Only the strong survive.
So you're listening to the Investor Resources live radio show. If you want to talk to us today about the market, questions about your portfolio, your friendly financial advisor gave you a hot tip over the week, and you're wondering whether or not it's really in your best interest, you give us a call. We probably can gin up an opinion about something or other. But let's stay on subject with the market, stocks,
sure,
bonds, exchange-traded funds, mutual funds, and the like. One of the things that most people have, whether they are aware of it or not, is a portfolio built on what the industry refers to as best practices.
Indeed.
So what's best about them, and who determined they were best? Well, there's no real research on it. The only thing that there is about it is that the compliance officers and the state and SEC auditors really like it.
They do.
Yes.
they can't even explain to you why, because we've asked them. You know, once you really get down to it, you know, why do you think this is a good idea? And they've got a few platitudes about what's going on. We're talking about, you know, a moderate investor in a 60-40 portfolio, 60% stocks, 40% bonds. So why is that so good? They don't really have a good answer for why they think that. That's just the way it is right now.
It comes under the old adage of, well, that's the way we've always done it.
That's it. It must be good, right? Let's take a look at that. Yeah.
Except prior to the 80s, we didn't always do it that way. In fact, it didn't exist until desktop computers became available and we could generate really pretty pie charts and punch out lots of numbers on a spreadsheet. I used to have those software programs.
Sure.
And I thought they were the cat's meow. And my clients liked them. I believed in them.
Didn't we all, right?
One of the assumptions was that correlations, the way different assets react at different times to price changes, is constant. That, ladies and gentlemen, is a myth.
It's absolutely, you can demonstrate that it's not true. And that's the key, because there is no evidence that that is the case. There's just long-term averages where you say, well, on average, if you look at 100 years of data, it's true. And it's like, you know, our point always is we're not investing over 100 years. We don't have 100 years of data. We don't have 100 years of time for this to work out. So it doesn't make any sense for investors, but that's the way your money gets allocated in those best practices using that pie chart.
Besides which, during that 100 years, there were periods of time where for 20 years you did not make any money.
Correct.
Oh, well, that's a best practice, isn't it? What happens if I retire during one of those 20-year periods of time?
Bingo. Yeah, now yeah, what? Yeah.
So part of what happens is the exact opposite of what the representation is, that when you reach extended market, let's call them bubbles, going think of the tech bubble, the GFC bubble, the great financial collapse that we just had in 08, 09, the 29 bubble. I mean, we find some of them, not all of them are all that big, but when we get into those periods of time, financial formulas about values show that there's exaggerated risk in the market, and the 60-40 says, doesn't matter. We're going to keep 60% in our stocks no matter how much additional risk we are creating in the portfolio, because we'll live long enough for it to be corrected. Well, you know, that's dumb, because that risk capital, and by the way, I bet if the kids ask you whether or not you worked hard to save that money.
Yeah.
Yeah, you're probably not going to say, yeah, no, that was easy. Yeah, I can do it again. Just, you know, just take me a couple of weeks and I'll have my couple million dollars back in the again. You know, that's not going to happen. That didn't happen. You didn't get there that way. And yet the 60-40 basically says when markets get extended and they make no sense from a risk management standpoint, it does not matter. We are going to continue to hang on to it, even though that light coming down the tunnel really is a train.
It's a train, and it's on the way. And they really do say, I mean, it really is a best practice to say, we are going to completely ignore the risk. We're going to ignore how far overbought or oversold this market is, and we're not going to do anything about it, because over the next 50 years, it'll all even out. I mean, that really is how that works. And you're never going to hear that from them. You're just going to see these big mountain charts that show you, well, over the 100 years, the market only goes up. And unfortunately, like you said, Don, yeah, but what about this 20-year period that doesn't look like anything but a little blip on this big 100-year chart? That's two decades where you would have lost money, you know, every year. And you can't afford that if you're already in retirement or you have investment goals for anything. You can't afford to just continually go backwards and not do anything about it. It doesn't make any sense.
So why is it working, or why is it the best practices, the gold standard of a portfolio structure, if you will?
Right.
And part of that is because most of the people in the business today and most of the people who are investing in today's world have been doing so over the last 40 years. That would put you at least in your 60s, but in reality, with starting a family, getting a job, having excess money to save, and having an amount that actually amounts to something, you probably didn't get started until you were mid-40s or 50, and all of a sudden you are stashing money in your then highest tax bracket to date, and it's expensive money, and you saved it. You don't want to lose it. And yet during this period of time, the 40% is your safety cushion of bonds. And so you've had bonds in what is a cyclical market. Long-term business cycles exist in the economy and they do in the markets. And so the bond market cycle has continually faced lower and lower interest rates. Some blips along the way. But if you go back and look at interest rates since the early 80s, it's a downward line.
Constantly,
And when interest rates fall, your bonds were going up. And so they offset partial deterioration of your stocks from time to time. It gave you enough that you could kind of gut it out, close your eyes and say, oh, okay, I mean, I've got these bonds and they're not doing that. In fact, they're going up. So I think I can make it through this one. And so you have this long-term bull market in bonds. Since the beginning of the year, the Barclays Aggregate Bond Index, which is your safety valve against falling stocks, your safety valve in the first 4 months of the year is negative 8%, 8.2 as of yesterday.
Not exactly a great buffer. Yeah, not exactly something to hold it up.
Yeah, there's your safety now. And what happens now? The Fed says, we're going to raise interest rates, which means your bond losses are going to continue growing. That's your safety valve in that 60-40 best practices, gold-plated portfolio. What are you going to do about it? You go talk to your financial advisor, the financial advisor says, listen, this is the way we do these things. Well, but that doesn't mean it's the only way to do these things. Prior to the desktop computer, nobody was doing a 60-40 portfolio. They were looking at market risk, and they were saying, that doesn't make any sense anymore. Let's sell that
turkey.
Let's
don't do that. That's what makes sense, but that's not what we're doing now. And, that 60-40 portfolio, the pie chart portfolios, that's modern portfolio theory, all invented by Harry Markowitz, and he said when he developed it, there's no predictive power in this process at all. We have no idea what's coming up based on what we're doing. So when things change substantially, we don't change anything as far as this goes, because it only looks backwards. And so it takes decades to have anything change. And right now, like you said, Don, interest rates are going up. The bond market is taking the hit, and that 5-6% return that was in your bond portfolio is not there, and it's not going to be there because rates are going to continue to rise. They have to fight the inflation that's flared up. So we know that bond component is not going to have the return that it had for the previous 40 years, and yet that's going to comprise 40% of your portfolio, even if it's consistently losing money. We don't think that makes any sense.
Well, certainly not. And the whole concept of, well, this is the way we do things, is carried over into other areas. One of the things that investors have done in trying to deal with low returning bonds, as they've put money into the markets in recent years, they have gone to other areas. They've gone to emerging market bonds, and they've gone to junk bonds. So emerging market bonds, well, that's not too bad. I mean, since September, they're only down 17%.
Emerging market bonds. Yeah.
and that's going to accelerate the problems of inflation, because most emerging markets are commodity dependent. And with rising commodity prices, rising dollars bad for them. Rising commodity prices should be good, but they can't sell the stuff. They can't get it out of country. So that's a problem for them. So the other area is that what's Michael's last name, and created junk bonds back in the 80s. Anyway, he did go to prison.
Yeah, exactly.
But the junk bond index has actually done better. It's only
Milken,
down 9.
Michael Milken.
The junk bond has only gone down 9% since last September. So the quality bond portfolio, diversified, is down 8. Well, that's from the first of the year. I mean, I didn't think about taking a look at the first of the year here. So junk bonds are only down, they're down the same, 834 instead of 8.2.
Yeah.
But that's the safety valve. People say, well, yeah, I need interest. I want payments, so I will take higher risk. And with higher risk, the assumption is higher returns come from higher risk. And people forget that higher risk means you may not make any money at all.
A lot of times it's just higher risk. There's no higher returns to go with that at all. And that's why you get paid more. You're at risk. And that means you also are at risk of losing that investment. And people forget that half of the equation.
So what's happened?
We're up against the break. Well, okay, we should go ahead and take a break. When we come back, we'll continue our discussion about 60/40 and bonds and how that can affect your portfolio. And I'd like to remind everyone that we do have our next monthly market update. I'd like to invite everyone to register for that by going to iriradio.com. That's iriradio.com. Just go to the webinar page and you can click the registration link. You'll be good to go. And on Saturday, May 7th, 9:00 in the morning, you'll be there for our next market update. And like I said before, we always have plenty of time for your questions. So if you have something that's been on your mind, good time to get a second opinion on it. Again, go to iriradio.com. If you have a question for us this afternoon, we'd love to talk to you. Give us a call at 800-465-8770. That's 800-465-8770. We'll be right back. Stay with us.
Well, moving right along here, we've been talking about bonds and
sure.
The difficulty of the bond market and what we believe to be the irrationality of a 60/40 portfolio and for some time. So what we're now facing, as I mentioned, we've been in this 40-year cycle of falling interest rates, and we're now shifting into a cycle of rising interest rates. Now, the Fed thinks they're only going to have to raise rates for a couple of years, but we're moving from zero to somewhere between 3 and 3.5, depending on which Fed president you're listening to. And the market may, in fact, drive it higher because mortgage rates are already pushing 5. We'll probably see that go above 5 before very long.
You would think so, yeah.
And the Fed doesn't have to raise their key bank rate up to 5 or 8 or 9, though they could. And Paul Volcker did.
I mean, correct.
I forget what the high was, but it was well into the high teens, as I recall.
Yeah, 18%, something like that. Yeah,
pretty close.
Yep.
And mortgage rates were 21, 30-year mortgage, 21%. I hope you're sitting down.
That's people's head to spin right now, wouldn't it? Yeah, people are panicking at 4.75. How about 21? Oy.
So one of the ways that interest rates work is, do you have buyers or sellers? You got a lot of people who want to buy the bonds. Well, they will bid up the price of the bonds, which means the interest rate's going to be lower. And how is the Fed going to actually deal with inflation? Because the Fed and the federal government created inflation. It's a monetary issue. They put more money into the economy than there were supplies to be bought.
Correct. That's it.
And so we had a bunch of money chasing limited supply, and people said, well, I'll pay that. I'll pay more. And so we end up with price inflation. It's a monetary issue. So what's the Fed going to do to reverse what it has caused? And it's been a bond buyer and now has more than $9 trillion of bonds. And at the current rate of reducing their balance sheet, it's going to take them, if they just maintain the current pace that they've said they would, about 8 years to unwind it. So when they become a seller instead of a buyer, well, now they're looking for buyers. They're dumping stuff on the market for the next several years, which is going to suppress value, which will cause the long-term rates, the mid and long-term rates, to rise even higher. So the long-term bonds, the cost of those is going to get more expensive. Mortgages will get more expensive. That's going to slow down the economy. Fewer people able to afford a home slows down the economy. The Fed doesn't want a recession. And if you're listening, and I'm sure you're not just staying on the TV waiting for one of the Fed presidents to make a speech.
I hope not. Yeah.
But I get these feeds that show up in my email, and basically they're all saying, well, You know, we're not going to cause recession. We know how to manage this. Yeah, yes, they know how to manage to create inflation and cause bubbles and cause financial collapse. They have been degrading our standard of living since 1913 when the Fed started.
When they first got on board. And it's important to remember that they're mostly academics, and they look at theory and they look at the way things should operate instead of watching reality, which can be very, very different, which is how they end up, you know, as they say, behind the curve as far as they are right now. They should have begun raising rates at least a year ago and maybe two, but they didn't do that because there were other factors in there, and they weren't looking at, well, what are the markets saying? And now they're going to try to catch up, but catching up means that they have to be in a hurry, and that's the easiest time for them to cause a recession, which is one of the things, like you said, Don, they don't want to do, but that's going to be tough. That's going to be a very, very tough line to stay on.
We have to remember that the Federal Reserve Bank is not part of the federal government.
Correct.
It is a private bank, and its primary job is to keep its member banks afloat.
Solvent, yeah.
So the Congress said, we don't know how to maintain full employment, so Federal Reserve, why don't you do that? Well, they haven't been able to do that either.
Right.
You were supposed to provide stability for the dollar. Well, they haven't been able to do that either. What have they done? They have created consistent inflation since inception, which has continued to erode our standard of living.
Well, and really, they've been trying to create inflation since, you know, 2007. They've been trying to get inflation up, and they haven't been able to. And now the government helped them out with fiscal policy of, well, let's just dump a ton of money on this economy and really rack up inflation, which was not their stated intention, but that's what happened. And now the Fed's left trying to fix that, even though the inflation that we're having now is not even inflation they caused. They were trying to for years and couldn't get it going on, and now forces out of their control have caused inflation, but it's their job to try to reel it back in. So, you know, good luck to them.
Well, they did cause asset inflation.
Absolutely. I mean,
they can't change buying patterns.
Sure.
So they made really cheap money that led to the mortgage debacle.
Kept it really cheap, yeah, for a long time.
And they did.
Time. Yeah.
And then trying to generate a higher rate of inflation over the last several years, they've just simply been a massive buyer of bonds, pumping money into the system, creating more liquidity. And now they're going to try and undo that liquidity. And the question is, what happens if we get a real sell-off in the market? Will they maintain their commitment to clean up their act? Or will they suddenly say, well, we can't have that happen. That's going to hurt our banks. And so they'll start buying bonds again. Nobody knows.
Right.
But it doesn't matter if you have a 60-40 portfolio. You're just basically supposed to put on your blinders.
There you go.
And everything will work out. You just have to live long enough and not need your money in the meantime. And then it'll all be okay. You know, we've been sucked into that often enough in our careers. We said, you know, sure, there's something wrong here. And reading a book by Benoit Mandelbrot, mm-hmm, called The Misbehavior of Markets is actually a pretty easy read. Now, you don't have to read the formulas. They give you the formulas if you're really into math and you want to
replicate this on your own. Right, right.
Yeah. But you can skip over that part. They explain what the formulas do and why they work and why the Kool-Aid that the industry gives us to drink isn't good for our financial health.
It's well worth your time. It's a great read. Again, it's called The Misbehaviors of Markets, and the lessons in there about the dangers of the status quo on Wall Street are so clear and so concise that it's well worth your time to take a look at that.
So we've had three long-term cycles of government bonds over the past 100 years.
Right.
And I would caution you that if you're running a 60-40 portfolio, you are on the cusp of a major cyclical change in bonds. We had the Well, I won't go through all, we don't need to go through all through those years. What's happening is interest rates are rising. The commodity costs are rising. We're basically looking, it looks like we are at a cyclical turning point for commodities, which have not been attractive investments for years.
Correct.
In fact, if we go back a few decades, you take energy was the largest sector in the S&P 500.
And by
now
far,
it's now the smallest. It's done that poorly. But here we are now with Russia and Ukraine basically not able to deliver massive amounts of agricultural and other commodity products, metals and energy, that are going to be off market for some time. It's going to disrupt the way the global marketplace works for these commodities. So it looks like we are entering into a brand new super cycle for commodities. And as that develops, that will eventually begin to show up with stronger emerging market positions. But like the 60-40 promoters, they've been telling us we should be buying emerging markets for the last 5 years because they're undervalued.
Right.
Well, they're more undervalued than they were then.
They're a better buy now than they were 5 years ago, right, because they've still been going down.
So the issue is, how are you going to deal with this? You need a strategy, and you can find out what our strategy is. If you watch some of our webinars, go to irradio.com, irradio.com. Click on the video tab, and I recommend you watch January's and last January's to get an introduction into how to look at markets differently than a 60-40 portfolio that actually works and is actually based on how portfolio managers manage the stock market for the prior 100 years or more. I mean, the 60-40 is a new deal. You've been listening to the Investor Resources live radio program. We're about to go unlive, but you want to talk to us during the week. It's 800-317-9119 or send us an email, help@irradio.com. That's help@irradio.com. So our plan, Lord willing, is we'll be back next week, same time, same station, and be able to take your calls then. In the meantime, God bless you, God bless your family, and God bless the United States of America. Heaven knows we really need his help right now. So have a great weekend. Call us during the week at 800-317-9119. 800-317-9119. We look forward to having a conversation with you. God bless you.